Hello, today with Ruben Timmermans in the Dutch EdTech podcast. Ruben Timmermans is the founder from Springest. He started Springest in 2008 in Amsterdam. It's a comparison website where people can find trainings and compare trainings. There are roughly 250,000 trainings on the platform from more than 7,000 suppliers. They're active in the Netherlands, Germany, Belgium, the UK, and Sweden. We talk about the story from Springest, how Ruben started the company, what motivated him to build this company, and we talk about the merchant acquisition with StudyTube that happened last month, and he tells how they're going to work together and what are the next steps and how this merchant acquisition happens with StudyTube. So great conversation, and you can learn a lot from an expert in the EdTech space from the early days. So good luck, enjoy. Hello, Ruben Timmermans. Welcome to the Dutch EdTech podcast.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Hey, we have you at the podcast and some news out in the beginning of this year that StudyTube acquired Springest. So we thought hey, it was a great moment to invite you for the podcast. So to tell us your whole story as an EdTech founder, what you have done in the last years and what happens. And then the whole process. So I look really forward to this conversation and just have a nice 1 hour learning from you, but also get some insights and your stories. So really look forward, but maybe really good for the audience to start. Could you maybe explain your background and what you have done before Springest, and then maybe we can start after that, like why you started with Springest?
Yeah, sure. So I had an online marketing agency before Springest. So I was from this online marketing world, doing search marketing and usability research. I was a blogger in those days, 2002, 3, 4. I was still studying then, and then at some point just stopped studying. So I never finished any degree. So that's good to know, maybe, as an EdTech founder.
Good.
EdTech founder without education. Yeah, for sure. And that was the best decision of my life, actually, to stop studying, because I just wasn't learning that much. And being an entrepreneur learned or taught me a lot more. And actually, that's how I got started with Springest, because I saw many markets like hotels or finance or, you know, housing, even, they all had their aggregators, their marketplaces, and there was no marketplace in the education space, or in the learning space, as I prefer to call it, actually. And so I just thought, you know, if I start one, then we'll probably be successful, because Google tends to have a diverse top 10. So if we are the only marketplace in learning, then we should be in that top 10. And that turned out to be true. So that's how I got started. But the online marketing world is really my sort of home base.
So interesting. And why that, did you have a sort of passion for education? Did you say like, oh, that's an interesting sector?
Yeah, for sure. I just love learning always. That's why I stopped studying. Sounds paradoxical maybe, but you know, if studying doesn't teach you much, or it's too boring or whatever, then you should just stop doing that and do something else. So I was always reading. I was always interested in increasing my productivity, you know, an early stage interested in things like getting things done, G2D, just always wanting to improve. And I was doing, actually, I was looking for a coaching training because I wanted to become a coach as well. And then a friend of mine suggested, let's just make a list of this, you know, a sheet, and put all the different coaching trainings in that sheet. And then maybe we should also call those companies and ask them for referrals to customers that they had already. Because how would we know if these coaching trainings are good? And that got me on this path. And that's, for me, was the perfect combination of actually in the beginning generating passive income next to my consulting and blogging stuff. And I thought, let's have this platform where, you know, I can combine those things. My passion for learning, because I'm always looking for that. And the fact that I understand online marketing, and I think there's a sort of a gap in the market in Google for a learning marketplace. So I just combined those things, and that that worked out.
Wow. And at the beginning, how was Springest in the early days? What have you done where you saw like, okay, hey, this is really going to get some traction? When did you get this feeling? You talked about online marketing, so when was this feeling? When was this moment?
I basically knew it beforehand already. I mean, I wasn't sure, of course, but I did some research into the top 10 of Google for queries like time management training or coaching education, stuff like that. And actually, I just knew that if we would set the site up right, it was then called EduHub, by the way, eduhub.nl. Later, we rebranded to Springus. That, for people who might not know, it's really 100% the same company. We just rebranded. Springus was actually invented this name by the founder of Funda, Mark Yoster. Thanks, Mark, for that. He was one of my angel investors at a later stage. So I knew quite certain that we would have a business. How big the business would be, that was the second thing. And so I knew I could rank in Google if I would just gather all this information about education companies. That's what we started out with, just a WordPress site. I was just adding content there, copy-pasting it basically from education companies' websites. And then I would call them up, and that's how I knew it would be a business success as well. Call them up and say, hey, you know, I'm Ruben, this online marketing guy. You can see my blog. You can see I'm legit. You see, I understand this stuff. And of course, I could claim I understood it better than them because I was this online marketing nerd, and education companies were pretty old fashioned. Still are in many respects, actually, which is good, I think, because they are good at what they do, which is teaching people stuff and not per se being a marketing machine. So I could convince them and say, hey, if you join this platform, you know, if you join now, you're still early. So that gives you a head start to your versus your competitors. And that's really what got them on. And I actually sold them a package for 6,000 euros per year. I just said, if you pay me the 6K upfront, then you will get your leads and clicks and bookings for free. But of course, there were no leads and clicks and bookings because it didn't exist yet. However, 6 or 7 or 8 of them bought into that. They paid that amount upfront. And all of them actually got a good return on that in terms of, you know, we later introduced the leads and the bookings and we got them. And we got them much more than the 6K they paid for in the end. So then I knew, you know, after the first few deals, like, hey, this pitch is working and they are afraid that they are later than their competitors. So if I get them on board, I can, you know, show the competition your competitor is there. And that, you know, that got the whole marketplace play going, basically. So then I knew it would work.
Oh wow! And you started in 2008, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, and how was that market at that time?
I don't think it existed really. A few years in, or maybe after a year or so, or maybe even sooner, we discovered there were some competitors, but they were really actually more books. Like there was a book. I don't know what they call themselves. Something like the Education Monitor or something. And they would, you know, publish this book every year with all the education companies in there. And then they put that online, basically. But there were no real reviews. There was no good search. There was, you know, all the basic stuff that Booking.com had. We knew we just had to build that. And doing that was you know, relatively easy. The harder part was sort of getting the platform going on from a marketing and sales perspective. But the technology was not, there was no big innovation there, of course, because we knew what people wanted. It was basically the booking.com experience. So that was what we were going after. But for the rest, there just was not much, and it was the same in every country. So we quickly saw, like, hey, Belgium, Germany, UK, they also don't really have leading platforms. There was always something, but it was never good. So we felt we could just be better and then, you know, win that marketplace market.
Yeah, and going further, step by step, Springus, how big did it became? What's the size, courses, country? Can you explain a bit more there?
Yeah, actually, first we were just eduhub.nl, and that went really fast, actually. The growth curve was never, after the first 2 years, it was never as sharp as the first 2 years. Of course, it's easier to grow when you're small, but we really quickly went to, like, you know, I think nearly 100K visitors a month. And in the end, we reached maybe 250, 300K a month. But that was, you know, after a year and a half or 2 years, we already reached the first 100K, because that was kind of the gap in the market there was already. If we would just show up with our platform in that market, we would get to that level pretty quickly. But then after that, it became harder to become really big. And that's, I think we did reach a level in the end where we were sort of the only portal where, of course, as an education company, you have to be on. And then if then of course later more competitors emerged, but then we were already the one you wanted to be on. And if you have your reviews and all your products on Springest, then you know, doing that again for a second portal or for a second competitor in the market is sort of feels a bit like a bit much, because you would have to do it all again. And the second one can never be as big as the first one. That's always the rule in marketplaces. Mm-hmm. So in the end, we and still have, of course, we have in the Netherlands about 8,000 education companies on the site. And of course, there's NCOI and LOI and Schouten & Nelissen are the big ones, the classical ones. But then also a lot of freelancers, a lot of ZZP'ers, as we call in Dutch. Yeah. So single person companies, basically. And a lot of them are on there, too. And they can now compete with the bigger companies if they are good at what they do. And that's what we reached. We have about 120,000 reviews on the site. And this is, that's the one place where you can see if an education company is actually good at what they do. We also launched in other countries in 2011, 2012. I raised a small angel investment round then. Before that, it was all bootstrapped, just based on my own income as a blogger and speaker. So for the first 3 years, we bootstrapped. And then I raised a small angel investment, not much for the money, but more to not be alone in, you know, tough decisions, because I was a single founder. So I kind of missed that. You know, the discussion or the also the criticism from the inside. Of course, I had colleagues, but it's not the same as an investor or a co-founder. So I got these angels on board, experienced people from Hives and Funda and Funk, you know, the let's say well-known Dutch e-commerce founders and network founders, and got them on board. And then we decided to go to the UK and Germany as first sort of new countries to see which one would catch on. And actually, both didn't really catch on. We just blew €500,000 on that from our own money and a bit of the angels. Also from Sanoma Media, we had funding a year and a half later when we really wanted to grow faster. And we blew their money on that as well. But at, in the end, Germany did catch on. So we opened an office in Berlin. There are still 8 or 9 people working. Now we're growing that again, of course. But Germany really caught on, and the UK didn't really catch on because the market was more US-like, more e-learning, less classroom style learning, and also more companies that are in the market already that are really, you know, doing affiliate marketing and that were not so much waiting for another platform. So, but Germany in the end caught on. So we have 2 offices in Amsterdam and in Berlin. Yeah. As I said, 9 people in Berlin, about 45 to 50 in Amsterdam. And that's where we ended up basically.
Wow. And in total, how much did you raise as an organization?
In total, only €2.5 million, something. It was really small amounts every time. And that's something that's one of the lessons for EdTech founders listening. It wasn't really, like, if you raise money, you should prepare to raise a lot of it, actually. And it's easy to say now, because in this current market, it's easy, relatively easy to raise capital. Back then, it was harder. Yeah. But actually, if you have, let's say, a business that has about €1 million or maybe €2 million, €3 million in revenue yearly, or let's say 100K in monthly costs, or, you know, those levels, then raising, you know, 4 or 5 times your monthly cost level doesn't really add a lot of power to your business. It feels like a lot of money, because we were profitable. We were always profitable, never made a loss, basically, except for, you know, investing in Germany and the UK, which cost a lot of money. But if you are at that level already, then it doesn't make sense to raise a bit of money. And it felt at the time that it would be useful to have, let's say, €1 million in the bank, but you blow it pretty quickly if you already have that level. So if you raise money, you should prepare to raise a lot of it, especially in this market. But also, I think in hindsight, we could have done without it. It didn't add that much to our business in hindsight. It was just a bit of money, but we couldn't do really, let's say, big investments. We couldn't hire 4 or 5 salespeople in Germany. We could only hire 1, and that doesn't have much impact. And then you're better off just bootstrapping it all, because then you're even more critical of what you're doing. So either, you know, go big or go home. I think that's still a thing that's correct.
Especially with the marketplace model, probably.
Especially with marketplace, and even more so if you want to go abroad. If you're going to go international, it will just cost a lot of money, and then you should really do it right. And it will cost you two or three times anyway. Any company that went to other countries will tell you, you know, you don't get it right on the first try. So you have to have that money too to try it again, to go back or to try another country or to hire another person, or, you know, it will just cost more than you think. And raising a little money to take the first step doesn't really help you. Then you're better off bootstrapping and doing it yourself.
I can imagine. Hey, and there's also always for some listeners, always the question about internationalization. What were your learnings from to make Germany work? Like, every country is different. You already said it. What were maybe learnings that you can share? It's like, now I knew it was working, or it took time for.
Yeah. For us, when it really started working was when Matt, one of our earlier employees, actually went there. He is German or half German, and he went there and set up an office there, hired German people there. We had German people in Amsterdam actually before that, and that didn't really work because it didn't feel serious enough, maybe even for ourselves, you know, in selling it and marketing it. Like having two or three German people in Amsterdam felt like a big step back then. It was like, they're German and it's real and there's a website and, you know, we translate everything properly and we have good customer service, even German phone numbers. But actually it really started to work when we had a presence in Berlin. And it's not that anybody would visit the office and actually check if we are there, but it just feels more real and it makes everybody feel real about it. And that makes it actually happen. So being in Berlin, having a small office there, hiring people there, doing local sales, of course, very important in Germany, which is very hard, costs you a lot of train or car or plane tickets. Just being there really helps, and knowing that you'll have to try multiple people, you know, hire people, then let them go again because the match isn't there. That's just something that takes time. But being on the ground was the most important thing, and having someone from the Netherlands that is German move there and set it up there, you know, also set up the culture there, be sort of the founder there, that really helped us. That's when it started to work.
Germany, you always hear from a lot of companies that Germany is a difficult market to penetrate, to open up. And it's interesting to hear also here.
It is, but we also found that, and I still believe that, because it's hard, it's interesting, not just because it's big. Germany is also not that big that in terms of learning, actually, ed tech. Germany has seven times the amount of people than the Netherlands, but only four times the education budget. So that's something for our sector to keep in mind. Actually, it's not that much bigger. Currently with StudyTube, we are more looking at the Nordics first. And to me, in the past, that didn't make much sense. You know, the Nordics are all small countries. You know, Sweden has like, what is it, 7 million people or something. And then Denmark, and it's all small. But they have larger education budgets per person. So that's something. And less international players going there. So if you're a US company and you come to Europe, you're not going to go into Denmark or Norway or Sweden. You're going to go to Germany and the UK. Yep. So the competition is also less. So that's also something to consider. And Germany is very, very competitive. But for Springist, it was a good move. We made it work. And we were the innovator, and we used that in our advantage. Like, we were the cool company originally from Amsterdam, but now having Siemens as the first customer. So we had the coolness plus the, they're a real GmbH, they're real, they're in Berlin, they're German people. That combination really worked well for us. I think Germany is still a bit of a blue ocean for Springest, actually. And now together with StudyTube, we can make it a lot bigger.
Cool, really interesting to hear. And around, because 2008 you started, the first years alone, and then you started with the team. What have you seen on, let's say, the EdTech trends and learning in the space from then till now? And maybe also the last 2-3 years with Corona.
Yeah, well, that's a long period, first of all. Yeah. I don't think back then nobody was calling it EdTech. And I don't like the word education so much, because to me, education feels like you know, studying. Yeah. So we always use the word learning more, but learn tech never caught on, which is fine. So we're in the ed tech business. I would say it became a lot more professional, a lot more funding went into it. Of course, we have this word ed tech, we have you doing this podcast and you doing Growth Tribe and all those things. It's a real industry now, that's for sure. At the same time, I think corporates still don't take learning seriously enough. That's what I still feel, you know. Many of them still think, okay, here we've bought a subscription to LinkedIn Learning or a subscription to Pluralsight or whatever learning, you know, library. And that's enough. And people can find their learning for the rest for themselves. And if you see how much money goes in into recruitment or into employer branding, it's still, you know, multitudes more than orders of magnitude more than what goes into learning. Even though learning should be more efficient. The thing is, learning is pretty hard. It's hard to organize. It's hard to wrap your head around it. If you just hire someone that has done the job before, managers tend to feel like, oh, that's certain. You know, this person already had the job before, so we hire him, and then it will all be all right. Well, if you choose to learn your people something, then you don't really know the outcome, and it's also hard to measure the outcome. You know, there's no title that someone then magically gets. Even though, you know, when they come from the outside, you also don't have a perfect assessment of who they are, but you have this feeling of proof. And I think there's still a lot to go for the edtech sector to make itself more relevant or more important versus, let's say, recruitment. I think I think it's still undervalued in that sense. And that's why I'm still excited for the sector.
100%. It's still young. And what you're now saying, it's difficult to measure. Do you see this is now, because like, let's say maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was hard to measure the outcome of learning on which metrics you want to use, whatever, productivity, engagement, using tools, speed, whatever. Do you think now, because you've seen also what kind of courses people choose on your platform, you see trends, I suppose, on your platform as well. Do you think now, because I completely agree that industries are not taking learning serious, if you think about like talent is so short, talent, the shortage is extreme, plus so much is changing as well. Business models, marketing channels are changing, all kind of elements. So only hiring, which is the buying strategy versus the building strategy, it's more and more, and it's also a little bit from my experience from Growth Lab, it doesn't make any sense anymore. I'm like, you can keep people, you can attract them, you can keep them longer if you help them develop. Do you think it's also timing? Do you think this will now change, or will it still take 10 years before we take learning serious, mainly for the industry and bigger companies? How do you see this?
Hard to say. I mean, people in this sector already, are already talking about this for years, of course, and HR people as well. And I think learning will stay very hard to measure. Like I said, hiring someone who has a title just feels like a check in the box. Like, it's done. I did it. This is the person knows how to do it, even though you don't have proof of that either, but they had this title. So it's the same. So I think it will stay the same. And it's maybe a bit the same with self-management or self-organization, you know, something we've been doing with Springist for years as well with Holacracy. It's not so much that you can prove that it's better. It's just that the companies who are better at it will be the winners. They will survive and they will be the better workplaces to work at, and they will win from their competition. They will be more agile. So it's more that I think in the end, you will see that the companies who have succeeded in creating a learning culture, you know, who have the budgets, who have the tools, who invest in that, who take it seriously. It's not that you can objectively measure that they are better than the others, but they will be the ones who are winning. They won't, they won't
outperform
be the Nokia.
Competitors.
They outperform, that's it. Yeah. I think that's that's the best way to measure it. And that's also, I think, the challenge for HR or chief HR, chief people. Like, you know, how do you show that your budget is worth it, that you're doing a good job? I think the best measure is not something that you try to measure in isolation about, you know, how much have people learned or how productive are they, but are those teams performing in their market? Are those teams performing at their function? I think that's the best way to measure it. Maybe plus measuring how happy your employees are, because that's generally a good indicator of how long they'll stay there and those kind of things. And then learning helps that. But yeah, the performance in the market is essentially what you want to measure as your learning impact. Otherwise, I don't think it's, I don't think you actually can. It's just simple as that.
Yeah. And any, I don't know if it pops in your head that you see any companies that you think, ooh, they will maybe not as the industry companies, but more as a provider, provide certain tools where they start measuring more the impact. Have you seen examples already? Or
No, I think that they're probably there. I'm just not so good at it myself, because I was always more focused on Springers and the mission we had there and what was already big enough. And the same now with SolidTube, it's still, there's so much to do that I don't have a good view on that. You would have to ask indeed the chief people officers or the consultants around who are good at that. So I wouldn't know. I think it's also very business specific, of course. You know, what is success in your business is very different from mine. So maybe you're better off asking people per sector, like who are the winners, which companies adapt the quickest, which companies grow the best, which companies retain their employees the best, and look at them and then see how they do learning and then learn from that.
Yeah, and but this is also, I think, the excitement for the upcoming years, which, as you said, we are still early and still a young sector, I think, if you compare it with, for example, fintech or health tech or whatever. Because, for example, now I think there are more tools to measure all kind of stuff, and the playbooks are not there yet. But and then if companies will use that, and sometimes it's a bit more long-term thinking, which we also see with learning. That's definitely true.
It's always long-term thinking. That's also a hard thing, you know? If you invest in it, you don't see a result immediately. It's not even within a year, I would say. It's something that is more of a cultural shift. So I think it's comparable, and that's why we ended up with self-management as well. That's something that will cost you in the beginning. It will be less effective because people have to change their ways and learn how to talk to each other in new ways. But once they are there, they don't want to leave ever again. And it's the same with this learning culture. If you start learning at a regular basis, you know, consciously, not just because you happen to do a certain job, which is, you know, the biggest part of learning anyway, but if you start to consciously improve all the time by reading, by sharing, by, you know, by consciously monitoring your own learning and planning for it and choosing learning goals and stuff like that, that takes a long while. And then before that starts to have impact on the business, it might be 2 or 3 or 4 years. So how are you going to measure that and still correlate it or causalate it back to the original learning investment? I think you really can't, shorter, besides looking at trends or stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting space. And there is a bit of like short learning now. Like in America, they call it speed learning, or macro learning, micro learning, where you can measure the quickly. So for example, if someone, his or her data skills are becoming improving, and you do 1 day the course, it's 1 day, 8 hours, the day after, you're going to analyze graphs and you present graphs in a different way. But I agree.
That of course is no impact. The impact of someone having learned something is useless, because that skill learned in the right way to use it in the day-to-day business to have measurable impact? I mean, to test if someone has learned about something, that's of course that's easy. Yeah. But to know if that has impact, I mean, maybe that's not even that easy, but just to do a test for certain hard skills, sure, that's doable. And there are so many companies doing that. But I think if you try to measure that as a company, then you're really staring at the wrong thing. If your management wants you to measure in that way and prove that people learn certain skills, maybe, I don't know, maybe if you, as a company, you want to say, become more data driven, you know, that's the quintessential example that you are also working on with Growth Tribe, I think. Yeah. You want to become more data driven. So you want to show that, 100 out of your 500 people have actually learned how to do pivot tables in Excel.
Yeah.
You can measure that. Yeah. It might be a goal. But I think, you know, if you do that as a CEO or as a chief HR or CFO, then you're really at the wrong level, I would say. I think you should have higher ambition than that. Actually see if it makes sense. See if people can then use those data skills to impact the business, you know, and how are you going to measure that? That's the important part here.
No, exactly. And there are a couple of companies where they are now measuring speed in the company. So how quickly our products, features, releases of stuff, but also how many times they run experiments, for example. Not only the website, but all other that's measurable. And also, for example, how often they use digital tools.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And those ones are examples now where you can see how, for example, digital savvy the organization is.
That makes sense. Still, of course, sort of, it's still, of course, not what you're going for, but it might be an indicator of that it might be working what you're doing. Or maybe you have the experience in one country or one sector that if people learn digital skills or if they use digital tools more, that then 2 years later the business becomes more effective. So then you have some proof. So maybe that could work. I'm not saying that it's immeasurable or impossible or not at all, actually. But I think in general, we're looking too much at this feeling of certainty. I think that's just something in our society. We prefer to be certain over being right, actually. If we just feel certain about something, we can measure it and we think it's true and it's correct and my boss also agrees, then we just stop looking because that's enough, you know, even though deep down we know it's not that certain and it's not really the result we're going for. And accepting that is the hard part for most people. It's just scary to admit that you don't really know. You prefer to fake that you do know over admitting that you don't know. That's what most people still have.
And have you seen in the because you see which courses people choose on your platform and do you also see that more is there a more individual trend happening or is it still most of the time from the employer side?
No, it's definitely more individual. That was also, of course, I mean, we are sort of, you said that in English too, navel staring, I think so. But anyway, I'm not sure, but we are, of course, looking in this Springist tunnel. And Springist was very much for self-managed learning. And that's what customers also picked us out for. Like, we literally won an award with T-Mobile for their self-directed learning program, of which Springist was an important part. So, of course, I would say that the trend is indeed more individual budgets for learning, you know, not management or HR telling you what to learn, but you choosing it yourself, maybe together with a manager or with whoever you're collaborating with. But I think in general, that is the trend because Springist grew, of course, and StudyTube also grew on the same trend of people wanting to take control for themselves and not, you know, saying, hey, Peter, you should learn this because we want you to go there. It's more now, hey, Peter, you have this job in this business unit. What does the market around this business unit need? And, you know, tell us what you want to learn and we'll facilitate it for you or we'll just give you budget to go learn it. I think that's definitely a trend, but that's not just a trend in learning. It's also a trend in, let's say, employer branding or however you want to call it. You know, if you don't offer people the opportunity to learn, they will just leave. And then you have to rehire people every 2 years that went, you know, that did their learning somewhere else. That's expensive.
Yeah, especially. And so much is changing all the time as well. So it's like those factors are even. It's interesting.
Although I must say I hate those cliches. I mean, we also use them in pitches, but this idea the world is changing ever faster than before. Fuck that. I mean, your industry was always changing, and you were always in competition, and the world was changing. So this idea that the world is changing faster than before, I find it totally uninteresting. I also don't have any proof for it. I think it's bullshit. I think it's just something to make CFOs actually listen to CPOs or whatever. I just hate it, but fine, whatever. If it's needed, if people buy it because of that reason, then fine. I like the argument better. If you ask your employees, why are you here? The question the answer more and more is because I want to develop myself. I'm at this company because I like the industry and I like my job and I want to learn and I want to develop. They want to develop. Well, you better keep them challenged then at this company because otherwise you're going to have to hire them again. That's really sucky. So I think that's the more important driver, more from within.
It's super interesting to hear. Yeah, I agree. I agree there. Hey, and a little bit more to the present then for you, with big news, StudyTube acquired Springist. Could you maybe I think always really interesting for the audience, and probably they are like, oh, when is Peter asking that question? Like, how did this happen? Like step by step, you don't always hear their stories, what happened, but it's really interesting from an entrepreneurial point of view, but also from a company point of view. Like, maybe take a step by step what you can share, of course.
Well, Strategy Group and Spring Nest, of course, saw each other in the market more and more because they were building from their tool perspective. They came more from the learning management and e-learning perspective into the learning procurement market. And we had to build more and more tools around our marketplace to accommodate our corporate customers. So we were growing towards each other. We saw each other in the marketplace, I mean, on customer level every now and then, but actually not that often. For instance, we both pitched to Ball.com, which they won, and I think there are a few that we won as well. But because they were so, they were more scalable than Springest, actually, StudyTube, because they came from the tool side. So that's a bit easier to scale because it's only SaaS. And we went for the bigger customers with our big marketplace, because big customers need big marketplaces because they buy a lot of training and they know, you know, it's not enough to have 20 training suppliers. We need 100 or 200 or 300 or unlimited. So we came from this big customer perspective. So we pitched every now and then for the same customers, but not that often. But we knew each other, of course. And StudyTube actually won the Best Opleider van Nederland award, I think, a few times. So they won the award that we instigated. So that was fun. So we always talked. My mom and I always knew each other. But usually it was more this friendly competitiveness. But as we were sort of growing towards each other, Homam invited me over to the StudyTube offices one day and said, hey, you know, we should do this together, I think. He was in the process of raising another round, and it made sense from his perspective to combine it with us and raising more money and potentially doing more acquisitions because the market was ready for it. And actually, I was ready for that as well. Not so much personally per se, because I was still having fun with Springest, but I felt that we would also have to become bigger or even a lot bigger if we would survive in the long run, and which was my ambition. You know, I was pretty happy with where Springest was, but we weren't growing that fast in the past 2 years because of Corona. So I felt like, yeah, I think there's still a good market for us. We have really amazing customers, you know, really big names that are in there for the long run, international already. You know, we had Vattenfall in Sweden, which is the number two employer there. We have RWE and Innogy and Siemens in Germany, all these huge, huge names with huge customer, with huge employee counts. So we really had something going, but if we wanted to take the next step, internationally invest a lot more, than I would have to raise money myself as well. And I was kind of stuck with that as well. Like, do I want to raise a lot more money? We had FD Media Group as a minority shareholder with Hall behind them. That's a huge company. But I felt that they weren't the right partner to, let's say, put down another 10 or 20 or 30 million like StudyTube was raising at that time. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do that because I was doing this for 14 years already. And to keep doing Springest, even if I would scale it up 10 times more, it would still be the same sector, roughly the same game. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do that. So actually, when her mom called and we talked a few times, at first it was more about, you know, let's do a partnership because we have this learning marketplace and they have these tools and maybe we can collaborate. They actually asked us a few years before that already, like, hey, can we use your marketplace for procurement because it's something their customers wanted? And then I think we said yes, but like asked them a lot of money to be like, here, okay, then pay us, you know? And they were like, fuck this. And then they built it themselves and it worked, but it didn't really have skill. So it didn't work good enough. So we were like also in a way stuck with each other, but then his offer became more, well, let's merge or let's acquire you. Because the companies were both pretty sizable. They are about 110 people, or back then they were, and we were with 55, something like that. So it was clear we would have to merge the companies on a people level and on a business level and on a product level. That was a huge undertaking. But since they were raising the money, the logical way to do it was an acquisition from their side. So that's what we ended up with. But it was pretty quickly that we, Homam and I, and also their other founders, Gerard and Sebastian Stepan, we were doing the same thing, and we also wanted the same thing, you know, to go big, go international, you know, go up against the bigger US companies, you know, Degreed coming to Europe and all those others who raised hundreds of millions of funding. Yeah. We wanted to beat them. We still want to beat them. That's the whole plan now. And it's like, well, we are roughly doing the same thing with comparable teams, comparable. We're both running Ruby on Rails. You know, so there were so many similarities, both in Amsterdam, actually. The new Study Group offices will be next to the old Springest offices. So it's like, yeah, we can compete with each other on this little Dutch German island, whatever. And yep. In the Nordics, maybe, where they were already starting. Or we can join, raise a lot of money, which they were doing, and then compete on the world stage. And that's, of course, a lot cooler and it totally fit my personal ambition as well. So that was just a logical move to make.
Yeah. So the personal, the personal ambitions were aligned as well to make it happen on the business level almost.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It just made sense. Yeah. Actually, I said, you know, I'm not up for raising a lot of money. It's not my style. I'm probably not that good at it. Maybe I could become good at it, but do I want to be good at it? No, I actually don't want it. And Homam is good at that. He was good at that part. I was good at bootstrapping, you know?
Yeah.
I'm good at the whole self-organization. He's more on the sales side. I'm more a product guy. So we have a lot of complementary skills. And to do this thing was good for Springest anyway. So I thought, well, great. Then if you can do that part, then I'll throw in my company and my shares and let's just do it together. It's actually the best of both worlds.
Oh, wow. And was this the conversation till, okay, let's do it? How long took this? Is it a couple of months? Or
No, that quick? From the first meeting to let's do this was, I think, less than a month. But then actually saying that, yes, let's do this to signing the deal, that's then another 8 months. That's how these things go. And of course, there was also the funding round, which was at the same time combining the deals. And of course, I had to negotiate with my minority shareholders as well. And they had options for buying more shares. So yeah, there was a lot of legal, a lot of negotiating in the end. And of course, I was selling most of my shares as well. So then this was sort of my first bigger exit. So I had to make sure I was looking out for myself as well. Plus for all my colleagues, of course.
Yeah.
You know, that was something I wasn't sure of in the beginning, like, hey, Springest is a very specifically, you know, made company with self-management and how we organize a very, very strong culture.
Yeah.
And don't just want to throw that out of the window at the same time, knowing if you get acquired, it's not in your hands anymore either. So it's not like I want to stay the boss or something, because I'm not anymore. So I know that some sacrifice has to be made there. But I made sure that the cultures fit good enough to dare to make the leap. And that's certainly the case. But that was the longer part was, of course, more the legal and the financial stuff that just takes a while.
Yep. Interesting.
Actually, we made the deal in the beginning of November, actually, or let's say mid-November. We announced it, I don't know, end of January or something. So then there's even more delay after that, of course, for PR reasons. And you have to sync with many, many companies, with the investors. So that took even longer. So for you guys, it took, let's say, almost a year ago, I think we started the talks.
And super interesting to hear. And are you now, you're joining StudyTube now? Or can you tell a little bit more what your next role will be or what you're going to do?
Yeah, so far mainly two things. The first thing is, of course, integrating the companies. So making sure all the people are sort of transferred into the new entity, that the culture matches, that we get the right tools. There's a lot we can learn from each other. So Springest was really good at having really structured ways of project management, those kind of things. So I'm introducing those type of things at StudyTube. And it's not a matter of, you know, saying, oh yeah, Springest does it like this, let's do it, because that won't work, of course. You cannot tell 110 people, like, hey, we do it like this, let's do it like this. You can't do that. You really have to merge those styles and those cultures. And that will take a while. So that will be my primary concern. And then I'm also working on reinvesting in springest.nl, or actually springest.nl and DE and BE and FR and all those public marketplaces, the things Springest started with, because they got a bit less attention in the last few years, actually, because we were so focused on the B2B, as was StudyTube. But we think the public marketplaces are really sort of an important pillar in the business.
Yeah.
It's still a big business also, by the way, but we just didn't invest in it so much because it wasn't growing so fast and we didn't need it that much for the B2B side. But actually, we do think it's important in the long run. So that's sort of my first huge project next to the integration itself that I will run.
Yeah.
And from there on, we'll see what comes up, what is interesting, what motivates me. I'm not the CEO anymore or legally, so I'm a bit more free, which I like. And I'll just do fun projects that help help the company further.
Wow. Amazing. Hey, and so the Springer brand will also exist next to the StudyTube brand?
Or most likely, yeah.
Most likely,
no,
yeah.
We'll have to see. Yeah. I think at some point we'll merge for the B2B part because we will merge those products into one big platform and then it doesn't make sense to have two names on there. But for Springers.nl and Springers.de and those are more public facing brands and we probably keep Springers for that. But who knows, it's something that I would like, but it's definitely not something that I'm married to. Like, you know, things change, things die. And I'm super proud of what we've built with Springers already, even if the brand would disappear at some point. Fine, you know, we had an impact. Many people worked there. People know what we're famous for. So we'll just see. I mostly would choose based on what is good for the company going forward, not so much on sentiment or other things. I'm not sentimental like that.
No, I think amazing run that you had so many years, and we know each other a bit already. I know you from the early days in the, from the startup tech scene started in 2014, maybe 2014, 15.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful to see develop and also join forces to become stronger. It's I think a beautiful next step. So
yeah, thanks
and. Hey, really cool to have that discussed. We always ask two questions in the end a bit because of this podcast. One is, what would you do if you would be the Ministry of Learning? We don't call it education, but Ministry of Learning. What would you do? Let's say the Dutch market, maybe European market, but it can be a bit four-term year horizon, but it can also be long-term. Like, so what are things that you would say, out top of my head, stuff that I would do?
Yeah, the first that comes to mind is cooperate with the market more because in the Netherlands, you have several portals of the government, some, parts of Werk.nl, which is part of the Dutch labor agency, UWV. But also Studiekeuze and things like that, that get supported by the government. And they essentially are rebuilding what Springers is, but then in a very shitty way because governments can't build websites, they suck at all the IT stuff. They fuck up all the IT projects they have. Yet if there is a problem around learning, they tend to look inside or ask the sector, but then more the learning companies like, how would we ever, create a good system for people to find the right learning? It's like, I've seen this 5 or 6 times and we have been asked a few times as well for our opinion and we would give it.
Yeah.
But we never got into any cooperation. And for instance, Springest itself has a new professions part, which is really interesting because we have a lot of data from a data partner, TextKernel, about how to correlate professions to learning. And we, of course, have the most learning data of any company. So, but the government's also doing things like this, like literally building a database of learning products and try to connect that to a taxonomy of skills. But we are much better at that because we have developers and we have 14 years experience and all that and much more data. So what I would do as a Minister of Learning is really get, maybe it's fine to have government agencies work on it, but not from a technology or a standard standpoint. And that's what they're trying time and time again. In Amsterdam, they're building House of Skills. And we are trying to collaborate with them, but that's going slowly because they are not a startup. So they should leave the startup stuff to us and just somehow request stuff of us and then point to that because that's almost always better than what the market can, what the government can come up with. So that's, I think, the biggest thing. Don't try to imitate the market or regulate it or you know create new standards, because that will just be, you know, kansloos, as we say in Dutch.
Yeah, and it's also a bit still. I had a conversation with the government last week about this. There's still a little bit the policy in the Netherlands is a lot of like, oh, we do it ourselves, and everything needs to be more public. Or government, and in other countries they are way further already. Like, oh, there's so much new we don't notice anymore. Yes, let's work way more with the private companies. All kind of even on public education, let's say high school. Cool. And it's strange to see that we as a small country and knowledge economy, we're still fighting that a bit, and instead of like. They're beautiful companies, exactly what you're doing, who can do this probably way better. But it's coming over and over. Yeah,
I kind of understand the fear, but you can at least give them a shot. You know, at least try it, and then see if they indeed fulfill the mission that you want as well. Because a private company always has their own mission as well, and they want to make money. So I get that, but then don't start to compete with your own, let's say your own the companies in your own market. Start to do that without trying to collaborate, then you know you're killing your own economy. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and there you have an argument that you can even use. Is like, I think you want this, the Netherlands or Europe, to have a bit of what you said also with StudyTube. You want to compete to the more American companies.
Yeah,
and I think if you have more local choice as a company and a government, you also can say, hey guys, we can work together. But we have a couple of rules around whatever privacy with data this.
Yeah,
and, and that's so supporting your local ecosystem, it gives you way more benefits.
I think so too. Well, that's so make me Minister of Learning, then I'll fix it for you.
That would be a good one. Yeah, definitely. Hey, and last question. I learned a lot. Thanks for being so open and sharing. It's always beautiful to hear the stories behind. One other question, the final question for the podcast we have is always, who should we invite next? Someone that you would like to hear on the podcast that I'm going to ask questions, be tough or not tough, but someone where you say, like, I would love to have that person once on this podcast.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't prepared well, as I told you already, but so there's not a name that comes to mind, but something that pops up now is ask someone from the customer side, maybe, you know, someone who has been chief HR or chief learning somewhere at a company that actually does that well. So maybe I can help you with finding the right person. You probably know some yourself, someone who really understands how learning in a company works or how learning. You can discuss this with, because I think that's something that startups are not always good at. I think we're pretty good at it with Springers and StudyTube, actually doing a lot of customer interview stuff like that. But to really go in the murky waters of reality in companies and ask them, how are you doing it? What do you actually need from your tools? How are your people using it? I think that's also something that our customers have often asked, and we haven't really helped them with it, although we always wanted to, but we just never figured out how or never spent enough time on it, is, you know, for other HR people to learn from each other. Because essentially what I think, which what many companies are doing wrong, is they think that they have a unique problem, but they almost never do. You know, even if you compare bol.com to some kind of, you know, whatever, a bank or something, let's say Aegon or Volksbank, customers of Springest, they have the same problems with their employees in terms of learning. You're not that unique, actually. And that's what I think managers at companies often think they are unique, but they all say, oh, our people are leaving too soon, or they're not learning enough, or we are not agile enough, or blah. It's all the same. So they should listen to each other more, and especially listen to their employees more, and see what they want. And usually employees want roughly the same things, you know, a certain amount of self-actualization, on top of the Maslow pyramid kind of stuff in the Netherlands, because we're so lucky to not have war at our borders or even in 100%. Our cities. So people roughly want the same things, and if you just listen to your peers, you will find out what that is and make life better for them.
It's a great we only had so far founders mainly and some investors on the podcast, someone from a tool. So it could be really interesting to have like a chief HR manager or a chief learning officer maybe, or a chief people officer.
Maybe a researcher. Yeah. I know a good one actually. Yeah. Paul van der Waal from NeedUp. NeedUp is a research agency that Springer operates with. Yeah. Yeah, and they do a lot of research, and actually they interviewed thousands of employees at companies and learned from them how they learn. How do you learn? How do you find the right learning? What tools do you like? What should your employer do differently? Yeah. So that's one. And another one, actually, now that I'm now I am coming up, is Marianne Bars.
Yeah.
But Marianne Bars is the researcher who did the best of Werkgevers van Nederland, and currently the best talent development company in the Netherlands award. That Springest, we ended up, I think, fourth or fifth last time, but we won it a few times as well. You know, those people know what's going on in the minds of employees with respect to learning. So maybe ask one of them.
Oh, those two suggestions are great. So I will definitely follow up with those two, and then we can invite them for the podcast.
Cool.
Say hi. Ruben, thank you very much for sharing and sharing some insights in the story. So I really hope that people listened and learn a lot from it. That's the main part. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Enjoy all you EdTech founders out there.
Yeah.
And by the way, if someone wants to ask questions directly, feel free to reach out on my website, ruben.org, or on LinkedIn or whatever. I'm really open. And if I'm too busy, I'll just say no. So never worry. Just ask. I like to connect. So let me know.
Exactly. And we're going to have an event together with Ruben in April, probably around Deep Dive with Dutch EdTech, where Ruben will also explain a little bit more questions from the audience about his story, fundraising, because you had a couple of investors on board. So so that one will be announced shortly.
Yep.
So
bring it on.
But thank you very much for sharing and be so open. And I hope you stay around because you have so much learnings and you're one of the first, let's say, real EdTech companies. So I still hope you're going to like this space. And then
I'll stick around.
Maybe, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Perfect.
Hey. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.